You're listening to the Table Podcast from January 8th, 2017. Today's teaching is titled, A New Year for Seeing.
So, welcome to a new year. Talk about arbitrary, right? I mean, the calendar, things like the calendar, like money, like time, these just massive constructs that we all agree about, right? That are completely things that we've just made up. But we act as though they were, well, they were real like gravity, right? You know, real like something that affects our lives profoundly, but which we can't explain. Welcome to a new year. How is this significant? Well, maybe it's significant because it's an occasion where, arbitrary or otherwise, we stop a little bit and we do that profoundly important human task of reflecting and planning, and we look back a little bit. It's a fairly typical pattern, right? The turning of the year, we think back on the year past and evaluate a little bit or muse a little bit. We look forward to the year to come. Maybe we make some plans. We consciously dream some dreams, you know, that kind of turning of the calendar stuff. So on the first time that we're gathered this way, on a Sunday in 2017, I want to do a little something kind of like that. James, whom Tim mentioned a moment ago, he's not here this morning, but James is sort of the web guru for the community. And there are a bunch of people in the community that help with its upkeep. I'm personally really grateful for that. Tim, Michael, you guys are here this morning. Brent does tons of this stuff. Really appreciate that, and really appreciate James' work on making it more phone-friendly, and that whole iPod subscription thing. I have mixed feelings about that. I have no reluctance at all about improving access and accessibility and availability and all that. No reluctance. But I'm the guy whose voice will mostly be in your earbuds. I'm glad that's not exclusively the case, but I know it's predominantly the case. And I feel as though, when it comes to the complex dynamics of exploring spirituality together in a community context, and when I think about the ways in which I believe that things like belief or spirituality are shaped or are held, a podcast, for all of its value, feels like it's missing some very, very important dimensions. And one of those I've sort of touched on already. I love that when I float an idea here at the table, I can look around and I can see your faces. I love that. And one of the reasons I love it is because although I don't know everyone's story, I know quite a lot of your stories. And those things they're always floating around in my mind and my heart when I'm thinking about how we could open up an idea or explore some aspect of belief. They're a super important part of the context for that, for me. Not least of all, because it remains my conviction that religion is not something that God makes and delivers to us as humans. We make religion. And that's one of the reasons why it keeps on changing and evolving. It's because the beings that make it keep on changing and evolving. Our circumstances are dynamic. They're not static. And so we keep coming into this realm of belief with new questions. And when you ask different questions, you get different answers. It sounds almost stupid when you say it that way, but an awful lot of the story of religion seems to be the story of people that are looking for something immutable, something unchangeable, something about which they can say, this is the truth, by which they mean, this is the belief that you can't argue with. This is the belief that trumps, no pun intended, all the other ones. I mean, even a quick glance at the history of any particular belief system is going to reveal that it's changed over time, and that it's going to continue to do so. So when we get together to explore what we believe, a hugely important part of my context is your stories. So when I look around, and I know I'm going to say something that I'm kind of like, well, this is an exploratory idea for me, at least. This probes some things that raise questions that don't have tidy answers, whatever. There's always a particularity to this stuff, if it matters. Had this fascinating conversation with a bunch of the university age, like the adult kids that are part of our context right now. One of them was mine. A couple others feel like they are but aren't. They're just dear friends that we've kind of known all their lives. And we were sitting around the dinner table and talking about their education. Smart bunch of young adults, like just on the ball. All doing great with their education, loving what they're learning, kind of finding their way. You know, I think I'm a music major because I'm a great musician and I got a scholarship, but what? I took a philosophy class and that's way more interesting. So off we go, you know, whatever, right? Just normal undergrad stuff, sifting and sorting. And so we just have this whole conversation about their education and what they're learning and why they're loving it and what's not working and all of this business. And we probably talked about this for like an hour. And then I said, so, what kind of world are you guys making? Like, over to you, you know, because, God, we, my generation, we did some things pretty good. We seriously messed up some things. Over to you, good and bad. What kind of world are you guys thinking about wanting to live in? Because you're making it. And the room kind of went really quiet. And it wasn't because they're not thoughtful, but it's because they could talk to me about their education for an hour with some passion and some insight and never bump into that thought. So at our dinner table last night, everybody was home for the evening, including our two university age kids. This came up again. I didn't bring it up. It just came up. Honest. And Davis, who's just finishing up an honors degree, so he's like in year five, said of this matter, he said, you know, when you encounter an educator at the undergraduate level that actually makes those connections, that actually says this idea that you're wrestling with in this class, this theory, this critique, this bit of insight, that actually says when we work with this, we're talking about the world out there. There's a link between this and that. He said, when you find an educator like that, they're a treasure. In his experience, that was not the norm. The norm was that the ideas exist out there somewhere, that they're an abstraction, and full stop. And that they're not. If they matter, they shape the world. Why is it that in our system of higher education, that's an unusual experience to encounter an educator who has what? The insight, the nerve, the choice, I don't know. All of those sound critical. I don't even know how to ask that question. Why is it unusual? Is the question that should probably remain standing. I don't know the answer. But I think it's a really intriguing question. Because what we say we believe, the things we're exploring, the things we're messing with as ideas, do not just exist out there. And this is one of my main critiques of the way most of us practice religion. Because we practice it like that. Like it was an abstraction, like it only existed out there, like it had nothing to do with the way we operate in the world, the kind of world we're making. Guess what? At the end of the day, nobody really cares about my abstraction. What they care about is the way what I say I believe impacts how I act, how I move in the world. Because that's what actually makes a difference to our human experience. That's what affects our context. I'm not saying ideas aren't important. If you've been around here for more than like a week, you know how much I love a good idea and how much I cherish the freedom to explore them. But if we're not exploring them in some way that connects to how we live, something really important just went missing. And that's where the stories come back in for me. Because when I want to explore an idea, and I look out across the room and I think, you know, if I say this way, that person's heart will break. Not because I'm so powerful, but because the idea is alive in the world and it matters. And the way we treat it matters. The way we explore it matters. Is there a way to open this important idea that's less heartbreaking, that might be healing? Is that possible? I don't know. It's worth thinking about. It's really worth thinking about. Context, right? Hugely important. Which brings me back to why I started to tell you about the website upgrade. When James was done his work, he sent kind of a report card to the team that had met with him late last year and talked about some of the things we wanted to have him look at. And And he reported on how he had addressed those matters on the site. It was very thorough, very helpful. So I went to have a look for myself, just sort of trying to be a responsible, you know, community citizen. And while I was there, I thought that I should review what I had written under the About tab. And it's been a while since I read it. I'm no great fan of my own work, like lots of people who have to write things down. But I thought that given the dynamic nature of community and belief that I just mentioned, the way these things move and change and evolve, I should have a look. And so I did. And it's still mostly good, I think. But there are a couple of details that I need to update. One of them says that we gather at 10 o'clock for coffee. When was the last time that happened? Anyone? Yeah. No. 10 o'clock, we're still plugging things in. I should say that. At 10 o'clock, we're still plugging things in. Just roll over, you know, hit the snooze button. Nothing happening here. Well, so I need to rewrite that part for sure. But how am I going to do it? Because it's a little bit difficult to know just how to articulate when we start, isn't it? Right? Like, we start when we ring the bell. I could put that in there. And that might be true, but it's not as especially helpful information when it's removed from its context. If you're looking at a website and wondering when you should show up and what it says is we start when the bell rings, there's that time thing again. That whole construct just went missing. Right? So that doesn't work. How about we start when we're ready to? Because that's more, like, that's more true, right? But, well, no, maybe it's not. Maybe it's less true because some of us could stand around all morning with our coffee in our hand and just have a conversation with somebody, and there's other people who can barely be in the room because there's so many humans in here, right? And everywhere in between. So, what does ready mean? Okay, can't say we start when we're ready. Some of us are never ready for all sorts of reasons. So I can't say that. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. But I definitely have to change the time because that's just not true, right? I mean, how would you describe what happens here?
A window. There's a window of time that we meet.
Oh, good. I think for someone who's never been and who's wondering if they should give it a shot, that's going to foster confidence. But you're right, Sarah. Like, what are you, right? This, sure. If I put ish in bold caps, some people kind of so shouted, ish, right? Yeah. That's a good idea. We could try ish. I think trying to describe start time is actually kind of a meaningful analogy for trying to describe the whole experience of what happens here, right? This is not that easy thing to do. I don't know if you've ever tried to explain to someone why you show up for this. It's an interesting experience, right? Especially because lots of times, it's a pretty normal context for us, I think, in our culture these days, to be having that conversation with somebody for whom the entire act is suspect. On a good day, it's suspect, right? On any other kind of normal day, it's like, why would I show up for anything that's tagged church or religion or that whole bundle, right? That's a, yeah, for all kinds of reasons. So how do you explain, how do you say, I hear you, I share a lot of those feelings with you, and for some reason, I can stand this. Sometimes, right? If I feel really energized, whatever. Like, that's a hard thing to explain, isn't it? I recently received a note from somebody here in the community that included a thank you for making a safe place for engagement with spiritual exploration and what they called faith-driven inquiry. I wept. Like, I just... It's like somebody just, you know, hit the button. Because that note went straight to the heart of why I do what I do here. And it stuck. It was like, oh yeah, that's right. That's why. That's why I'm doing whatever I do here. It just encapsulated that for me so directly and so powerfully. So when I was reviewing the website, I had that in mind too. Context. And I realized that what I was trying to do in that short little bit of writing was to find a way to address all kinds of stories and objections and hurts and bafflement and skepticism and faith on the margins and unrequited longings and unfulfilled hopes and of course, that's impossible. Which is why, in the end, what I wrote there is mostly an attempt to extend an invitation. Because those things are not answerable in that sense. What's written under the About tab on our website is, from my vantage point, an attempt to extend the kind of invitation that I dream of us acting out when we're together and when we're not. For me, that invitation is rooted in the belief that there is no such thing as spirituality without context. There is no floating abstract of this, always contextual. And that context is both personal and communal. It's theological and it's cultural. It's religious and it's our religious. It's body, mind, spirit, and so on. It's a matrix. It's a complex. That invitation is also rooted, for me, in a particular ancient story, a story that's part of my own context for belief. And it's a story about skepticism. It's a story about doubt. It's ultimately a story about transformative belief. But it's a story about a cloudy, hard-to-define kind of transformative belief. It's a biblical story. I find deep resonance with this particular story, even though it comes from another time and culture. And it comes from an historical context about which we know so little that even our very most erudite and accomplished scholars can't seem to agree about the ultimate shape of that context. It's a story about a couple of individuals named Philip and Nathaniel. It's found only in the Gospel of John, and it's only barely found there. There's a pattern to the biblical stories about Jesus gathering this little band of close followers. And that pattern is quite consistent in the biblical stories. Whenever somebody in those stories has an encounter with Jesus that rocks their world somehow, one of the things that they seem to consistently do is they dash off to tell their family and their friends about it. They get mixed results, something that, you know, we might have experienced. This particular story is interesting in part because of the way that it talks about how those mixed results unfold for one particular character in the story. In this case, it's the character of Nathaniel. And as John tells this story, John has just finished being bowled over by an experience of the powerful experience of the presence of the divine, which he encounters through the person of Jesus. A person that John calls in one translation a God revealer. I rather like that. Not least of all because it assails the often unexamined idea that only in Christ, as a human, could we have an encounter with the divine, which is not something that Christ taught. So John's just had this experience with Jesus that's kind of knocked him over. And he says in so many words, he's writing about himself, so this is always kind of interesting. But he says in the Gospel of John that he really doesn't know much about this guy, except that he has had such a powerful encounter with the presence of the divine in him that he knows, and of course we know things in context as well, just like we make things, he knows that this is the Jewish Messiah, that this is the long prophesied deliverer of Israel. So if you're steeped in the Jewish narrative, as John was, that is a very big deal. Been a long haul at that point in the story. It's a big enough deal that some of the folks who've been attracted to John's kind of wild and woolly ways and his counter-religious cultural message, they kind of want to check this guy out for themselves. So these people, the next characters we come to in the story are disciples of John who have heard John talk about his encounter with Jesus, who are like, oh, really? Well, that's interesting. And so they sort of start stalking Jesus. Like, it's a sentence or two in the story, but it's kind of interesting. There's no kind of direct encounter. Jesus kind of has to notice them there for them to show up in the story. They don't kind of make themselves known. And so when Jesus finally senses their presence and asks what they want, they rather obliquely ask him where he is staying. To which he replies in a similarly oblique manner, come and see for yourself. And they do. Spend the rest of the day with him, John says. And they're so knocked out by the experience that they promptly follow the pattern and they go off to tell their family and friends about it. Jesus moves on, goes to a neighboring town, and in that town he comes across another relative of some of the folks that have already been attracted to him as a teacher, and this is a guy named Philip. And Philip is also convinced by his personal experience that Jesus is this long-awaited Jewish Messiah. And he goes to find another hometown buddy of his, Nathanael. And when he finds him, as John tells it, what Philip says to Nathanael is, "We have found the Messiah. The very person Moses and the prophets told about, his name is Jesus, the son of Joseph from Nazareth." To which Nathanael replies, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" I love that. Another translation, he says, "Nazareth, you've got to be kidding." Right? Like, what the... See, Nathanael knows about Nazareth. He's almost from there. He's from the next town over. Nazareth, the archaeological record suggests, was very tiny, like 150 people tiny. Like, there's more people in your apartment building tiny. Not all that well thought of. And not just by outsiders, but by people from within its own culture. So it's not a well-regarded place. So maybe that's Nathanael's problem, right? Maybe what we're hearing in this story is just plain old prejudice. Like, could be just the ancient story version of nothing and nobody good comes from that side of the tracks, that side of the river, that end of the city, right? That's possible. It's not an unreasonable thought. Or it could be that Nathanael, like any good Jewish lad, has heard the rabbi expound at synagogue about the prophecies regarding the Messiah. And he knows, just as well as that band of scholars that we talked about at our Not Quite Christmas gathering that Herod consults when the Magi show up, Nathanael knows just as well as them, because he sat in the same rabbinical schools, that the Messiah doesn't come from Nazareth. The Messiah comes from Bethlehem. It's right there in Micah. It's in the text, right? I mean, this is not the sort of thing that you should get confused about. There is just so no way that the Savior of the beleaguered nation of Israel is the kid of some carpenter who is from the dump that is Nazareth. So now what we have is the possibility of knowledgeable, informed, religious prejudice. Right? It's got information behind it. I think one of the reasons that this story, this profoundly Jewish ancient story from which I am distant in so many ways, connects with me so deeply is because I feel like I get Nathanael. I feel like I could be the guy in the story who knows the story. I grew up with it. I was in church prenatally and perpetually thereafter. I know the story. I've been told my whole life how it goes, what it means, where and how it happens. I know how to answer the questions. I know how to refute the naysayers. I know how to dodge the dodgy bits. I can recognize mistaken belief at 50 paces, in the dark, in the rain. Right? I have education in this stuff. I know how the prophecy connects to the history, connects to contemporary reality. I was in that class. And there is no way, anything good can come from any other understanding of the story than the one that I've been handed. Right? It's not prejudice if you're right. Right? Well, I don't know where the wisdom came from, but Philip, in this story, does what is quite possibly the only helpful thing that can be done in the face of deeply informed skepticism and prejudice. The only thing that can really be done productively when prejudice is so deeply embedded that it's invisible to the holder of the prejudice, which is the way most of us hold our most harmful prejudices. He does the only thing that can really be done. He extends an invitation, right? What he says to Nathanael is, just come and see for yourself. So that's what I was trying to say in those couple of paragraphs on the website. Just come and see for yourself. I give up trying to explain some aspects of this experience. I quit on a good day. Bad day, I still try and forget myself. I think I should be able to do this. I can't do this. And I'm okay with saying just come and see for yourself, not because I think this is a model community. There's lots going on here that I think is lovely and beautiful and good and right. There's also a fair bit of nonsense, but pretty normal. So I don't want to say come and see because I think this is like we've landed in this idyllic place or experience. And I'm not okay with saying come and see, because I can promise, as a person who has some spiritual leadership responsibility in this community, I can't promise any sort of particular encounter with the divine that's exclusive to this gathering or to some particular theological reconsideration or exploration. That's not within my purview. So I'm not okay with saying come and see, because I hold out that promise. And I'm not going to hold out that promise because I know, or because we know in some way that no one else can, how the story ought to be understood. I would extend the invitation to come and see for yourself simply because I don't know of any other way to assail all the so often legitimate reasons we have for not believing that God might be present in the midst of our stories, in the midst of our everyday lives. Man, those reasons are so easy to find. If we think God primarily exists to deliver whatever our Western idea of a good life is to us, that's God's main gig. So we think of God primarily as a divine magician with a great big candy store in the truck right behind him, sort of Gandalf. I know it's not candy in the trailer, but anyway. If we primarily think about God that way, then all it takes is one hiccup. One of those life does that, glitches. One of those questions that don't have an answer. One of those stories that I hear playing in my head as soon as I look at your faces. All it takes is one of those. And we just got a perfectly legitimate reason to go, forget it. Not interested. Right? But if we think of the divine primarily as mystery born to us by story, present in story, that's a different matter. That's something that we can explore. That's something we can come and see for ourselves over and over and over again without exhausting it. As soon as we exhaust it, by the way, guess where we just landed? We just landed in that hubris-laden place where we know the right answer and everybody else is wrong. And we've got the same dilemma right away again. One glitch in that system that we're so sure about, and the whole Jenga thing just comes crashing down. When we're convinced that nothing good can come from fill in the blank, a particular place, creed, practice, race, religion, when we're convinced that that's the case, that's not likely going to shift unless we actually check out the alternative possibilities for ourselves, unless we go exploring, unless we go and see. It's the only way that happens. And so as we head into a new year, my hope for us as a community is that we will keep doing all that we can to extend the invitation to come and see. First of all, to ourselves. And sometimes that's the hardest work, isn't it? We have to be willing to do that. It's not a simple matter. First of all, to ourselves, and then as our own story unfolds, to those in proximity to us, the people that, when Jesus was trying to unfold this mystery, that he just called our neighbors. The people with whom we have proximity. That kind of an invitation, if I can manage to find a way to say that in a paragraph, or to even gesture toward it in a paragraph, as a guy whose voice is in your earbuds, I feel okay about that. In peace.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about our community at thetablewinnipeg.com.